watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Our first speaker this week, author Bill McKibben, has been writing since the 1980s on humanity's impending collision with climate, trying to alert the world to the understanding of a problem that was emerging even then. Two decades later, we're now at the 11th hour, and nothing substantive has been done. He says a people's movement comparable to the civil rights struggle of the 1960s is necessary. To that end, he began the Step It Up campaign to urge lawmakers to take action. McKibben's talk focuses on getting to solutions and the kind of society we need to become in order to reduce our carbon footprint. The world he envisions sounds good to me. Locally grown food, distributed renewable energy generation, a world where community, people helping each other, is at the center. Following McKibben's talk, we'll hear an interview with Gregory Green about his new documentary film, Escape from Suburbia, the sequel to his documentary, The End of Suburbia, that longtime listeners heard a radio adaptation of on this show a couple of years ago. Green's work focuses on peak oil, but as you will hear, the dilemmas posed by peak oil and climate change have common solutions, if people have the will to make them happen. The clock is ticking. Bill McKibben spoke on September 26th at Cornell University as part of a program emphasizing local agriculture as a solution to reducing greenhouse emissions. Organizer Scott Perez will introduce the program.
Good evening, and welcome. Glad to see you all here tonight. When we decided to bring this speaker in, we knew there would be some interest. What we didn't know is how many people were interested in making sure he got here. So, you know, this movement basically has been student-led, along with some staff and some friendly faculty moving on up into the university system. It's really grassroots. And that's the way we got to get things done. You know, we know that things are, the way we do things are unsustainable, and we know that humans have had an effect on the climate. Matter of fact, the only people that don't seem to realize this happen to be in the White House and in the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. So, even some corporations are starting to pay attention. I read that yesterday that Walmart has actually advanced their sustainability initiative. But I think we're at the tipping point, and we can push this thing over the top. To introduce our speaker tonight is Steve Golding, the Executive Vice President for Finance and Administration. And Steve has been the voice of this movement to the administration at Cornell. Steve?
Thank you. I would like to add my welcome to everybody here tonight. As you know, we are here today to listen to author, educator, and environmentalist Bill McKibben, and that he's been brought to Cornell, as we heard, by just a plethora of faculty, students, staff, and undergraduate student groups led by Scott Perez and the New World Agriculture and Ecology Group. all of you ought to be congratulated for your commitment and your willingness to participate in bringing Bill here, who has been a persistent leader in the activism movement for climate change issues since the early 80s, with such books as The End of Nature and Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and Durable Future. He has been a thought leader that has resonated with any number of people on this campus. And we want to welcome him here today as we try to increase our own efforts of creating a culture of sustainability at Cornell. And why do I feel comfortable in saying that we want to create a culture of sustainability at Cornell? I say that because last February, President Skorton committed Cornell to the American College University President's Climate Commitment, an aggressive plan towards achieving climate neutrality for this campus by the middle part of this century. It should not be lost on anybody what President Skorton knowingly did in launching the university on this path and what its implications are for the university in terms of the infrastructure that we will need to build and to promote in order to achieve that goal. What steps we all take as a university, as a country, as a planet, are still very much in question, though. And it's going to take great minds and lots of passion, inspired by people such as Bill, and to build a climate movement that can successfully solve the challenges that face us in the coming years. So I would like to introduce Bill McKibben to give his lecture. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. It's really a privilege for me to get to be here. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. The town of Ithaca and Cornell University are two of the most important places in this movement, in the new possibilities for what the world might bring. There are people at this institution and people in this town that I've learned a lot from over the years and who have done truly amazing things. And frankly, I'm almost the last person that you should really be listening to about this question of how to build a movement, because as I'm going to begin by saying, I'm more or less a sort of accidental activist who's kind of, in the last year or two, stumbled off the sort of straight and narrow path of a life of a writer, which is what I've mostly been, and found myself more and more and more politically engaged. And so I want to tell you these stories a little bit about this, mostly on the theory that if someone as clueless as I can do this, so too can absolutely everybody else in this room. And I know that many of you are, and I want to try to get all of you deeply and actively involved in this climate movement before this evening is over. So let me tell you a story about last year, August of last year. I'd just come back from Tibet and India, where I'd been doing some reporting for the National Geographic and for Harper's. And of course, I was in very remote parts of Tibet, and every time you turn a corner in Tibet, you see in the distance some pilgrim prostrating themselves on the way to Lhasa or to Mount Kailash or someplace, and it's an indelible and beautiful sight. And then when you get to India, if you're paying attention, you know, you can't help but sort of trip over the tracks of Gandhi and his, you know, various walks and marches and things as you're wandering around India. And I think I was primed when I got back to Vermont, where I now live, to be thinking in terms of some of that kind of example of walking. I was in great despair about how little was being done about global warming. I mean, Hurricane Katrina had come through. Hurricane Gore had come through with the movie. Everybody had seen it. And still there was absolutely nothing happening, you know. In the U.S. Senate, every piece of legislation dealing with climate was sent directly to the person that the Senate thought was the right person to deal with climate legislation was a man from Oklahoma named James Inhofe, who kept announcing that it was a hoax, and to make sure he didn't disabuse himself of that notion, summoned as his only witness last year at the climate hearings the novelist Michael Crichton. Nothing was happening, and nothing had happened in the 20 years that I'd been working on this issue and writing about it. And So I just said, something's got to be, got to do something. And I called up a couple of writer friends of mine in Vermont and said, look, let's walk up to Burlington, our main city, and we'll sit in on the steps of the federal building, and we'll get arrested, and there'll be a little story in the newspaper, and at least we will have done something, you know. You can see clueless is pretty much the correct word. And these other writer friends of mine said, okay, we'll go, because they're sort of about as acute as I am. And but happily, someone called up to the police in Burlington and said, what would happen if we did this? And the police said nothing would happen. We could sit on the steps of the federal building pretty much forever. No story in the paper, nothing. So they kind of implied that if maybe we need to sort of burn down the federal building. So we calculated what the carbon emissions from that would be. And instead we did this, we just sort of converted it into this kind of pilgrimage. We just started emailing everybody we knew and said, look, 3 weeks from now we're leaving on this walk. Come join with us. And we left from Robert Frost's old summer writing cabin up in the Green Mountains, because we, you know, liked that most cliched of all high school English class poems about the road not taken. You know, it seemed apropos. And we started walking, and we walked for 5 days, and we would camp in fields at night, and we'd do programs in churches in the evening, kind of thing. And by the time we got to Burlington, there were 1,000 people walking, which for Vermont is actually a very large number of people. It was enough to get all of our candidates for political office to come meet with us down on the shore of Lake Champlain for our final rally, and not only to meet with us, but to sign on to the pledge that we were asking them to sign on to. We were asking them to sign on to this pledge calling for 80% carbon reductions by 2050, which a year ago was a very radical position. Went far further than any of the legislation anyone had introduced. It was really at the far extreme. But everybody signed up. Now, some of them we knew would sign up. Our wonderful then representative, now Senator Bernie Sanders, maybe the most progressive person in all of Washington. He was so delighted to see us all arriving in this march. He said, came running out. He loves, you know, organizing and activism. He said, this is great. This is great. I haven't seen this many people in so long. This is so great. What is this about? And, you know, but he signed right on, and he's become the great champion of, he happens to sit, the only senator sitting on both the Energy and the Environment committees in the Senate, and he's really emerged as a linchpin in this struggle. But it wasn't just him. Everybody, including the conservative Republicans, signed on. The woman who was running for Congress on the Republican ticket and who came close to winning, the adjutant general of the Vermont National Guard, a woman named Martha Rainville, had said 2 months before, when she announced her campaign, that she wasn't sure that global warming was real and that more research needed to be done. Okay? The extremely important revelation for me was to find out, to see that the more research that needed to be done was how many people were going to walk across Vermont to ask this question. It worked the way it was supposed to work, you know? We made enough noise, and she heard it, and she not only, she signed the pledge, she put herself, that picture of her signing the pledge in every TV commercial that she ran the rest of the campaign. She carefully photoshopped out the names of all the other people who signed it. It was really cool, and it was really, for me, brought home in a way that sort of, that I think maybe in some ways I'd allowed my cynicism to erode over the years, the real possibilities for political action still to have effect. Now, the only downer to this whole thing was to wake up and read the Burlington Free Press the next morning and see a story saying that this 1,000 people might have been the largest demonstration that there'd yet been in the United States about global warming. And to see that and think, that may have something to do with the fact that we're not getting anything done, you know? And as I thought about it, you know, I wrote the first book about this 20 years ago, and I've been involved in it all along, and that sort of seemed right. There really had never been a kind of mass activism We had all the superstructure of a movement, you know, the scientists and the economists and the policy people and the engineers and some corporate involved. What we didn't, the only part of the movement that wasn't there was the actual movement part, you know. And so we wanted to see if this was just a Vermont thing or if we could do the same thing on a larger scale. And so beginning in about January 10th of this year, we opened a website. Now, we in this case, and this is important for people in this audience to hear, we in this case meant me and six kids at Middlebury, 22 years, about to graduate. Some of them graduated during this and some at the end of it, but just at that age. So the same age as everybody, you know, if you're Cornell. Launched this website, stepitup07.org. We asked people to set up rallies in their communities on April 14th. Now, we didn't know what to expect because we had no money at all and we didn't have any organization. We didn't have, like, lists or anything. We just started emailing, writing, and whatever. Our secret hope was that we might organize 100 of these demonstrations by April 14th, which would have been about 100 more than there had been before. But instead, thanks to all kinds of people, including all kinds of people in this room, the thing just took off around the country. Using this sort of viral power of this new technology that we have, people suddenly were just jumping on board from every direction. And in the course of 11 weeks, we organized 1,400 of these demonstrations in all 50 states. They all took place on April 14th. And it was amazing fun to watch, and it really made me understand just how many, because this was not clearly due to our brilliant organizing. You've seen, it's really not anything we really knew anything about. What we did find out was that all across America, there were all kinds of people, and I mean all kinds of people, who were desperate to have some way to take action that mattered on this problem. Many people who'd been sort of haunted by it for a long time, but it felt too big. There was no sort of crack to stick the screwdriver in and start jimmying, you know. People kept saying things like, you know, I put in the new light bulb over my kitchen table, but as I was doing it, it occurred to me that this might not actually stop global warming. So what could I do? And just sort of, just by this sort of coming to just as if, almost as if we'd given people permission to how to sort of do this, and people just rose completely to the occasion. I'll talk more in a few minutes about Step It Up. And about the new version of it that we're doing this fall that I hope you all will be involved in. I'm going to back up for a minute. I'm going to talk about climate change more generally. I know that you already know all this, okay? But it's the kind of catechism of our time, to be repeated almost until we're able to explain it to everyone else, just the kind of sequence of events, how we know what's going on and the extent to which it's going on. And I'll make it as brief as I can. But it's important to be able, I think, to just lay it out for each other on occasion. Really, people started publicly talking about climate change really almost exactly 20 years ago, 1988, 1989. The End of Nature was the first book about this topic, and it came out in 1989. And at that time, global warming was still very much in the order of a hypothesis. Now, I thought a strong hypothesis, but at some level, I mean, we knew enough science to think it was a strong hypothesis. We knew that CO2 trapped, solar radiation near to the planet that would otherwise have gone back out to space, and all the models showed that it should be a problem. On the other hand, it just seemed emotionally counterintuitive. How could one species, ours, actually have grown large enough that we could affect the most fundamental system on the planet, the climate? It seemed somehow unlikely. And so in the period from roughly 1989 and roughly 1995, science went to work with more resources and more person hours and more skill than have ever been in a similar period concentrated on any single question. You know, we send up weather balloons and satellites, and we cored glaciers and ponds, and we did all those kind of things, mostly refined those huge computer models that tell us what is going on with the world's climate. And by 1995, the world's scientists, gathered together by the UN and something called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, by 1995, were willing to state, yes, the planet is getting warmer, humans are the cause, and it's going to be serious. It was a kind of coming-of-age moment for us as a species, this declaration that we had grown this large. Since 1995, it's been as if the planet itself has been sort of peer-reviewing that work to make sure that it was correct. All 10 of the warmest years on record follow that 1995 declaration. Really, what we can now say, the only thing that's changed in any real sense since the late 1980s, is our understanding that this is coming faster and that it's bigger than we would have guessed then. So far, human beings have raised the temperature of the planet 1 degree Fahrenheit, roughly 59 degrees to roughly 60 degrees. We would have said 20 years ago that that was just the kind of, we'd be just on the sort of threshold of the globally warmed world with that kind of increase in temperature. But our models underestimated how finely balanced the planet was. And in fact, that 1 degree has been enough to kick us fully into a globally warm planet, a planet that's changing with enormous speed. My friend, the author Lynn Cherry, who's here tonight, just handed me a new book by Gary Brash of photographs, hundreds of photographs from around the world of things that one can now see that are related to this rise in temperature, even this so far fairly modest rise in temperature. And you all have seen all those things and you've heard about them. You know that hurricanes are becoming more powerful. We've this year seen the first year in history when two Category 5 hurricanes have made landfall in the Atlantic. Now, we didn't pay too much attention to them because they made landfall in Central America. So what the hell, you know? There they were, incredibly powerful and incredibly strong. We know that aridity in dry areas is increasing dramatically. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold, so we're getting far more drought in dry places, truly record drought. It is amazing to talk with people in Australia now and have them relate the experience of what it's like to be in a country that's just drying up. Drying up so fast and with such sort of scary implications that in one of the more bizarre political conversions of recent times, the Australian media mogul Rupert Murdoch, owner of Fox News, announced a couple of weeks ago that he'd become a believer in global warming and was going to make his entire empire carbon neutral within 2 or 3 years. That gives you some strength. I'm a Methodist, so for me that's sort of proof that the Holy Spirit is actually at work in the land, you know. But it's some proof of just how grim that drought has become. Probably most, if not most importantly, most dramatically, has been what's going on in the Earth's cryosphere, in the frozen portions of the Earth's surface. Put simply, everything that's frozen on the Earth is melting, and melting with enormous rapidity. Permafrost is melting, and as a result, all the methane much of the methane that's stored beneath that permafrost is beginning to escape into the atmosphere in truly mind-blowing ways. I've talked recently with researcher friends who've been up in Siberia, and they say that there are now lots of places where even in the middle of the Siberian winter, lakes and marshes and things aren't freezing over because there's this endless bubbling up of methane gas, enough to keep them open all winter long. Arctic sea ice, the white cap above the northern part of the Earth, has of course been now melting, as you know, for a number of years. The previous record minimum extent of ice was set on September the 21st or 22nd of 2005 at about 5.2 million square kilometers, okay, which was dramatic reductions of the order of 25% from the average over the last 30 years, a big change. This year, we passed that minimum on August 16th. Since that time, ice has been melting at the scale of about a United Kingdom a week. Sometime in the next few days, we'll finally reach the point where the northern night gets long enough again that that melting process ceases and some refreezing begins. But the refreezing is going to not proceed as usual because there's so much more and so much warmer water than's been there before. Instead of reflecting, you know, the white ice reflecting 80% of the sun's rays back out to space, all that blue water is currently absorbing 80% of this incoming solar radiation. The minimum this year, as of a couple of days ago, was about 4.2 million square kilometers, or more than 20% less than the previous record. I mean, it is, as one researcher at University of Colorado who studies this said in an interview a week or two ago, it's as if the ice has just fallen off a cliff. You know, we've never seen anything like it, and it's just... And all of that is adding... Well, I mean, all of that gives us great confidence that the computer models are at the very least correct and probably underestimating what it is that we can expect. The best mid-course guess for this century, and not guess, estimate of the computer models for how much the temperature will warm is, unless we do very dramatic things very rapidly, another 5 degrees Fahrenheit or so. We'd go from 60 degrees now to about 65, which is warmer than it's been probably since before the beginning of primate evolution, in a completely different world. But that's not even, you know, the worst case. We're now beginning to think that those temperature increases may do far more damage. I mean, they're going to do, we could talk endlessly about their effect on agriculture, on the spread of disease-bearing insects, on all those sort of things. It's going to be miserable and tough in any event. We're now beginning to really worry that red lines may be approaching of just utter catastrophe. James Hansen, our foremost climatologist, the NASA scientist, defied a gag order from the Bush administration about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago now, and gave a speech at the American Geophysical Union where he said his computer modeling showed that unless within about 10 years we were able to reverse the flow of carbon into the atmosphere, start putting less carbon in a world as a world instead of more, i.e. start using less coal, gas, and oil instead of more, that we were past red lines, temperature increase about 2 degrees Celsius, that past which we could no longer count on the stability of the great massive ice sheets above the West Antarctic and above Greenland. If those melt, well, we'd long assumed it would take a long time for those to melt, precisely because they're a mile and a half thick. That's a lot of inertia, you know. It's hard to see how you'd go about melting that much ice. And the computer models assumed that you would melt a little bit on top as temperature warmed and it would kind of evaporate politely off into the atmosphere. But it turns out that's not what's happening. That as that ice melts on the top, it's quickly finding its way in these sort of rivers down to the bottom of those glaciers, and they're serving to kind of grease the skids for their slide into the ocean. And if that process really goes any further, gets any more out of control, the results are so... I mean, there is something like 80 feet of sea level rise in those two ice sheets, Greenland and the West Antarctic. Jim Hansen testified in court last year under oath that he thought it was now becoming possible that we might see 20 feet of that in this century if we weren't able to... Well, you know, 20-foot rise in sea level changes the Earth so profoundly it's almost impossible to even begin to conceive it. I mean, every coastal city on Earth is you know, unbelievably altered. Great percentage of the world's arable farmland disappears. hundreds of millions, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of people need somehow to find a new place to live, almost all of them in neighborhoods where there's not a lot of available real estate to go look for. Every coastal storm becomes just that much more of a threat. Suffice it to say that the number that Jim Hansen and others have given us in the last 2 years to work with is 450. 450 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is a line past which misery turns to catastrophe. And it's going to take every bit of our ingenuity and every bit of sort of fighting spirit that we can muster to keep us below that line. Okay? But that's our task. The good news, and there is some, is that the solutions, the ways to deal with this problem, are much clearer now than they were 20 years ago. Okay? 20 years ago, for instance, when we environmentalists talked about sort of new technologies, things like wind power and solar power and stuff, we did it with our fingers crossed because it wasn't ready yet. You know, we would sort of say it was, but it wasn't, at least for sort of prime time. Solar power was something that sort of noble aging hippies did down in the basement with, you know, arrays of lead acid batteries and topping off the water and, you know, was not going to happen across America. But that's not true anymore. You know, a few years ago, the Japanese, who, because the Kyoto Treaty was signed in their country, took very seriously this issue, decided that they were really going to do solar power in a big way. They started subsidizing half the cost of putting photovoltaic panels on people's roofs. The subsidies worked the way that they're supposed to work. Pretty soon, there were a lot of people doing this. That demand soon led to the construction of the largest solar panel factories in the world, all of which are in Japan. They learned how to make them far more efficiently. The cost came way down. Within 5 years, the Japanese government eliminated the subsidy altogether, and yet the installation curve of solar panels continued just on the same steep climb. The same thing is now going on in Germany, has been going on in Germany for the last 4 or 5 years. Germany and Japan lead the world by far in solar installation. Is that because Germany and Japan are the sunniest nations on Earth? It is not. Even compared with upstate New York or Vermont, they're relatively dark and clouded places. But they have the requisite political will to do what needs to be done. Wind power is the fastest growing source of electric generation around the world. And you can go to places where it, you know, if you go to Denmark, say, you know, it's producing more than a quarter of the electricity that people consume. There are windmills everywhere, and it's all happened in the last 10 or 12 years, you know, and much of it done by municipal cooperatives and people in fairly small groups getting together and clever financing and government support. It took no huge technological trick. It took a certain amount of political will to make it happen. We've come to understand far more about the amazing amount of energy we could save through conservation and save relatively easily. You know, the advent of just the most easy technologies like those compact fluorescent bulbs is a good guide to how much waste there is all around in our appliances, in you know, almost everything we do. Cars the same way. You know, the advent of hybrid automobiles, something that no one had even heard of 10 years ago, you know, offer the complete possibility that every car in this country without any problem could be getting 50 miles to the gallon all the time. You know, I've been driving one for years, and what do you know, they work just fine. There's no great mystery to them, except that, you know, Detroit doesn't yet want to make them because we don't have the political will to make that happen. So the technology is closer and clearer than it was 20 years ago. So is the policy. 20 years ago, we didn't really know how on earth we'd even go about tackling this problem. But people have slowly converged on you know, the kind of mechanisms, the policy mechanisms that are probably going to be required. And they have, in some form, involve setting a cap on how much carbon can be emitted each year and then ratcheting that cap down year after year after year. Now, the ways in which one does this are going to be important and contentious, okay? The answer that corporate America would like to the question of who decides how you get the permits to put this carbon in the atmosphere is they would like to just be given those permits on the theory that they're already emitting all this carbon. They're the ones who control the energy supply, so they should just get the right to keep doing it and not pay anything for it. A much more likely explanation, or a much better result, and one that's gaining a lot of steam even in the last 6 months, is the idea of auctioning off those permits and using the money, A, to do some of the work we need to do to rebuild our energy system, and B, to give people a rebate back to help cover some of the cost of the extra cost of fossil fuel that'll come when we've capped and begun to reduce the amount that we're using. We understand how to do that, theoretically anyway, in this country, and we even have some idea how to go about the far more daunting and difficult task of how to make an international regime that would accomplish much the same thing. Again, everyone's converged on a relatively limited set of answers that require the transfer of a lot of technology and a certain amount of wealth from north to south in order to compensate people for in China and India and elsewhere for not being able to burn all the coal that they possess, to allow them to develop the ways that they deserve to develop without having to do what we did to get there, which is fill the atmosphere with carbon. Even some of the changes in habit that we would need to undergo in order to bring down our carbon emissions are becoming at least a little more obvious and a little more palatable. You hear more and more discussion of them anyway, everything from local food to figuring out a transportation network that doesn't depend so much on private cars to whatever else. It's not as if they're mysterious, it's that they're not easy. And so far, we haven't had the political will to make them happen. And that's what I want to talk about for the rest of this night. What hasn't gotten clearer over that 20 years is the politics, especially in this country. They're just as confused and difficult and just as much in the control of vested interests, at least for the moment. It's really uninspiring, our political record on this problem. The first President Bush, running for president in 1988, came closer to sort of rhetorically dealing with this problem than anybody since. He said, memorably, "I plan on fighting the greenhouse effect with the White House effect," he said, which was a very good line. Would that he had actually meant it, you know. The problem really emerged in his next campaign for president. Some of you will recall that that was the year the Rio summit was taking place in Brazil. And with much arm twisting, President Bush was convinced by his handlers that he needed to go to this event, put in an appearance, because all the other world leaders were going to be there. But as he left, and this was during the election campaign, he said something to reporters as he was standing on the tarmac that I've heard quoted back at me 1,000 times from people around the rest of the world. He said, "I'll go to this Rio conference, but the American way of life is not up for negotiation." What he said. Which, if that's the position you take, you might as well not go. You know, you might as well not do anything. Because if we're unwilling and unable to change in any significant way, then there's no possibility of dealing with this greatest of problems that we have ever faced. And really, the Clinton-Gore administration proved no more willing to take this on. President Clinton came into office promising to cut U.S. carbon emissions back to 1990 levels by the year 2000. That is, he promised to do the work in that period to turn around this great ocean liner, and at least bring it to a halt, if not turn it around. But then he didn't do it. Congress didn't give him any help, and he didn't waste any political capital on it. And America was producing 12% more carbon by the end of the Clinton administration than when he began. And then, of course, the current president came to office, and he wanted nothing to do with any of this. Within a few weeks of taking office, he had repudiated the Kyoto process, told the rest of the world that we weren't going to participate in any way, and that was that. Walked away from it for six and a half years. This week, he's finally summoned other major emitters for a conference in Washington, but it's very clear to most observers that it's really just an attempt to kind of head off the UN process and keep anything important from happening for to play out his term in much the same way we seem destined to play out the war in Iraq for the rest of his term too and just hand it off to whoever comes next. The greatest shame of that, of the current President Bush's efforts, was not what didn't happen in this country. It's that by walking away internationally, we surrendered any attempt to change the energy trajectory of China and India as they were beginning their rapid energy takeoff. And history will judge that as an even greater folly than the war in Iraq, I think. If we had summoned all the diplomatic skill that we had and all the resources that we could have brought to bear and all the technology that we had, there is at least some chance that we could have significantly nudged China in a different direction 6 or 7 years ago, such that perhaps they'd now be opening one new coal-fired power plant a month, not one a week. Okay? To let that process get out of control will have more effect on the geological future of the planet than just about anything else that an American leader has done for a very long time. So we are in a difficult position now. We are up against it. We have a few years. If Jim Hansen said 2 years ago that we have 10 years left and we have 8 years left now, well, 8 years is two presidential elections, it's four congressional elections, and really, given the fact that we have to sort of slow down this huge momentum, it means that the next election probably will be decisive about whether or not we're going to do anything. To make progress on the scale that we need to make, therefore, we need a powerful movement in this country making real demands, holding people accountable, working with the same kind of passion and moral urgency and willingness to sacrifice that the civil rights movement exhibited a generation ago, and doing it more quickly than they were able to accomplish what they did accomplish. The problem with it as a political issue is that we can't do at this point what every other movement, including the civil rights movement, was able to do, which is engage in the kind of political give and take, you know, and compromise and move partway and go a little bit at a time and all of that. If we'd started 20 years ago, we would have been able to, but we didn't. So now we have to figure out how to do it quickly, because the forces that we're contending with aren't interested in negotiation. Physics and chemistry don't negotiate, okay? They don't horse trade. They're not going to meet us halfway. They're not going to respect a good effort and whatever. They're just going to do what they do. And it's we who have to figure out how to meet them, not halfway, but all the way. What kind of movement might allow that to happen? It's got to be a very broad movement. It's got to take in all kinds of people. And happily, that's starting to happen. Starting to happen in all kinds of ways. One of the ways that I knew that this Step It Up thing was going to be a success was a few days after we started it. We got in the email a photograph from a sorority chapter at the University of Texas at Austin, the Alpha Phi sorority chapter. And there were 180 sorority women, and they looked just the way you would expect Texas sorority women to look. Every one of them could smile more broadly than anyone in upstate New York can smile. They were holding up, smiling around this big poster that said, "Cut carbon, step it up, Congress, cut carbon 80% by 2050. And they appended a little note to the bottom when they mailed it in this email. They said, "We wanted to show it wasn't just the hippies who cared about this." And that struck me as really, I mean, just one of the sweetest things I'd ever seen. Because, of course, it's hippies who start things, you know, the kind of people who live in Ithaca or Vermont, you know, those of us who see the world slightly out of kilter, you know, whatever. We're the ones who start things, but it's sororities and evangelical churches and chambers of commerce and all those who move things, who finish things, who move them into the mainstream where they can't be ignored, you know, where they can't be marginalized. They play a really crucial role, and they're beginning to play that role. It's been incredibly good in the last year to watch the evangelical Christian movement in this country decide that it's going to take global warming seriously. And this was not an easy thing for them to do. The National Association of Evangelicals put out a strongly worded policy statement last year about the need for Washington, for the White House and Congress to address seriously this problem and preserve God's creation. This was the first break between that community and the kind of Republican orthodoxy in this country. It took enormous, they were way outside their comfort zone when they were doing that, way outside their comfort zone. And some of the sort of mullahs of that movement didn't like it. And, you know, Jerry Falwell denounced the whole enterprise and said that this was just a silly pagan distraction from the important work on gay marriage that needed to continue and, you know, on and on and on. But they've stuck with it. And it's been very important politically in helping to sort of soften up the opposition some. And it was wonderful to see, you know, all kinds of churches holding these rallies last April. It was really moving. It obviously needs great involvement from students. And that's coming, and coming really fast. And it's really powerful to see. There are people here in this community who've played really important roles in that. I don't know all of them, but Carlos Reimer, who's up there, senior here, has been one of the really emerging leaders of this whole movement. While we were doing, you know, he led a march across New Jersey, right, as part of their sort of Step It Up thing, right, at the same time, and it got all kinds of coverage. He's helping organize this huge conference for the same time that we're doing Step It Up. It's in coordination with this Power Shift conference that's going to be going on at the University of Maryland and hopefully drawing 3,000 or 4,000 students from around the country. It is really electric to see that starting to happen again. Middlebury, where I'm sort of loosely connected to, it's one of the hubs of this thing, and the biggest single student organization on campus are kids meeting to talk about climate and take action on it. I mean, it's really powerful to see it happening, and just in time, because, of course, they're going to have to live with the results of all of this longer than the rest of us. This is, you know, not their children's lives that are really on the line here. It's their lives, for all of their lives. That's who it has to be. It has to want a lot of things. It has to want those caps on carbon emissions and saner policy, but it has to want it, I think, if it's going to work in the context of real social justice, too. One of the really powerful parts of this movement that's emerging is that component of people who are thinking hard about how this transition to a new energy future might involve all kinds of Americans who our economic past has left out of the picture. One of my favorite people involved in this movement is a man named Van Jones at the Ella Baker Center in Oakland, California, who has put together with colleagues an ambitious and really powerful Green Jobs for All program that lays out how we can take unemployed people from around this country and train them for the work of putting up those solar panels and installing that insulation and doing the work that has to get done if we're ever going to meet those targets. And that's important. Maybe most of all, this kind of movement needs some sort of vision of the world to come, the one that we could build, in distinction to the one that's going to happen if we don't get going and going fast. And that world needn't look depressing or grim or strained or any of the things that people sometimes picture. You know, one of the most powerful pieces of anti-environmental rhetoric that there's been that managed for 20 years to keep us from raising the automobile mileage standards in this country was the ability of senators to get up and say, oh, if this happens, they'll be like clown cars. Everyone will just have to pile into these little teeny, you know, cars. And, well, it's true, we're probably going to have to get out of the SUV business. But it's not true that we have to, you know, imagine ourselves in completely weird and impossible circumstances to deal with what's coming. How many people in this room have been to Western Europe sometime in recent times? Okay. You'll testify to the rest of the people in this room that Western Europe is a reasonable place and people live okay lives there and, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, if you're planning your honeymoon, you're sort of more likely to head for Paris, maybe, than to, I don't know, Atlanta or something. People in Western Europe who live lives just like ours do it on one half the energy that we consume per capita. Half is a big number. It's way more number than we're going to get from, you know, hydrogen and nuclear and all the other sort of technologies that we could sit here and toss out, okay, at each other. It's a huge number. And they don't have any secret technology that makes it happen. They just have a slightly different way of organizing their lives. A ways that we're quite capable of imagining here. We were talking earlier this afternoon at another venue here at Cornell about, for instance, the question of food. The way that we've organized our eating habits is completely bizarre, viewed from any, you know, distance. In the last 50 years, because we had all this cheap oil, we built a system that brought the average bite of food 2,000 miles before it went down your gullet, you know. That's an enormous energy cost, and so it should be very good news that the fastest growing part of our food economy all of a sudden is farmers markets. Ithaca has one of the greatest farmers markets in the country. The example from that has spread all kinds of other places, and it's really starting to make a difference. It's not just food that can work like that. You know, think of almost any commodity. Energy itself, you know, we're used to consuming it the same way that we consume food. It comes from a great centralized place, you know, instead of Cargill or Archer Daniels Midland, it comes from ExxonMobil or Peabody Coal or something. It comes to us and we consume it, but it could work entirely differently. It could work like a farmer's market. On my house, I have solar panels. They're connected to the grid. I have my utility when the sun is out. You know, my neighbor's refrigerator runs on the sunlight that falls on my roof. Okay? It works like the internet works. People put in and people take out. That's good for all kinds of reasons. It's good not only because it lets you put more ecologically benign technologies to work, it's also good because along with things like farmers markets, it helps us to do what probably is going to be the most important thing that we have to do to deal with climate change, which is rebuild some sense of community and rebuild it quickly. Our inefficiencies are directly tied to the, and our unbelievable consumption are directly tied to the ways in which we have come to view ourselves. Cheap fossil fuel had a lot of effects. One of them was global warming. Another one, in some ways just as pernicious, was to make us the first human beings in the history of our species who had no need of our neighbors for anything. If you've got a credit card and a telephone or an internet connection or something, it makes no difference if everyone around you disappears, you know. You don't need them. 3/4 of Americans don't know their next-door neighbor. They may know their name, but they have no relationship with them. That is an incredibly weird thing to have happened to a socially evolved primate. And what do you know? It's not making us particularly happy. Since World War II, since the people who do the sort of polling and survey work on rates of satisfaction in American society find that the number of Americans who say that they're very happy with their lives peaked in 1956 and have gone slowly but steadily downhill since. Many of the people in this room, me included, missed the happiest years of American life. Why is that? To the best extent we can tell, it has to do with this deep-seated sense of a loss of community and a loss of connection. Okay? How could that have happened? Well, what did we spend our money on since the end of World War II? More than anything else, we spent it building suburbs. We built bigger houses farther apart from each other. What did that do? Well, one, it drove up the amount of energy that we used astronomically. You know, people commute hours to work. People live in houses so enormous that just the sheer cost of heating and cooling that space, the carbon footprint of them is almost beyond belief. The size of the average American house, a new house, has doubled in the last 20 years, even as the number of occupants in it has gone down by almost a full person. That's one consequence, that energy consequence. The other consequence of that has been this incredible loss of community. We run into each other less often. The average American eats meals with friends and family and neighbors half as often as they did 50 years ago. The average American has half as many close friends as they did 50 years ago. Half as many. That's what we traded in for all that extra stuff and all that extra square footage and whatever else. And it just turns out that it was an unwise trade in all kinds of ways. We were past the point when more was actually helpful and to the point where it was too much of a good thing and causing us real harm in all kinds of ways. And so the good news is that as we try to do some of these things that we need to do to deal with the desperate emergency we find ourselves in, they point us almost naturally in the direction of more community, of more connection. The most important thing about a farmer's market is not how beautiful or how fresh or how local the food there is. The most important thing about a farmer's market is something that a team of sociologists found a couple of years ago when they followed shoppers. First, at a supermarket and then at a farmer's market. Everyone here has been to the supermarket. You know what happens. You walk in, you fall into a light hypnotic state. You visit the stations of the cross around the corner of the supermarket. You emerge with the same collection of items that you had the week before. That's it. You maybe have that conversation about paper or plastic at the checkout, okay? When they followed people around the farmer's market, they had 10 times as many conversations per visit, an order of magnitude more conversations. It's a whole different thing. And it's the whole different thing right back in the direction of how human beings have always lived and shopped since we had agriculture and shopping and markets, you know, the sort of social engagement that came with it. Let me end just by trying to relate that back to these questions about protest and movement. One of the things that we need to do as we build this movement is make it a way to build community and build connection, which we badly need. And it was one of the things that was so beautiful about this Step It Up thing that we did last fall and hopefully about the one that we have underway now. On April 14th, we had people from all 1,400 of these demonstrations upload photographs of their demonstrations to the website that day as they were going on. Because we wanted to take this dispersed local thing that we were doing and also make it a kind of national thing. We had all these dignitaries in Washington there to kind of watch the returns come in, as it were. And we started putting stuff up on the screen, and it was just so, just sort of straight off the computer as they came in. And it was so gorgeous that I probably should have brought pictures, but I'd rather use a sort of a kind of virtual PowerPoint technology, okay? If it works correctly, the pictures will appear in your minds, you know.